We're not little, tiny, longer-haired men. We are a full human, and we deserve our own research. None of the studies that ever looked at hormone replacement has ever showed an increase in mortality. Still, to this day, we're bikinis to medicine. We are reproductive organs, that's it. It's not a magic pill. You have to look at the underlying root causes and start addressing them.
So, Betty, why are you so passionate about women's health as a topic, and what are we getting wrong about it in this day and age?
Oh my gosh, how many hours do you have? That's a loaded question. We make up 50%, a little actually more than 50% of the population, but I think almost all of us are drawn to the thing that we are passionate about because of our own experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, it really came from my diagnosis of colitis first and, you know, kind of going down that road and all of a sudden learning like, oh, you know, 10, you know, out of 10 people, 9 are women. I'm like, well, that's an interesting statistic, you know, for autoimmunity. And then you start looking at other risk factors, heart disease, you know, Alzheimer's and dementia, 3 out of 4. And so the reality is we have such an enormous gap in women's health, and particularly around research and legitimate research, that, you know, for me, my 40s were terrible. I experienced really horrible perimenopause, despite having a gigantic functional medicine clinic and everybody that's everybody on a Rolodex. And I was like, if I'm experiencing that, being as connected as I am, there's a gigantic gap. And so that's really it. It's my own personal experience. And then recognizing that this is no longer okay to be like, oh, you know, women are just little, tiny, hairy, longer haired men. Like, I don't play that. We're not bikinis. We are a full human. And we deserve our own research.
Agreed. So I'm going to ask you about that research and why it's missing. But first, I want you to help people understand, what are we supposed to do about hormone issues and dysregulated hormones in a world where we're getting this onslaught of endocrine disruptors from the chemicals in our food, air, and water? How are we supposed to navigate that with hormone issues today?
So here's things. Like, I'm obviously really, really logical. You know, I've been in software before, engineering, obviously biochemistry. That was like my love language.
Yeah.
And the thing that never meshed for me was, okay, if we look at women as a whole, about 4 in 1,000 will have the risk for a breast cancer over their lifetime. I'm going to use this as an example, right? And so, but when you go through menopause, that starts to accelerate at this extraordinary rate, right? And then by the time you're about 85, it's 1 in 8, right? And so you go, okay, we've been told by conventional medicine, estrogen drives cancer. But yet none of the studies that ever looked at hormone replacement in a woman ever showed that estrogen actually drove the increase of cancer. And none of them showed, not a single one has ever showed an increase in mortality. And so I looked at that and I go, okay, so let me do the logic thing. So if we have our hormones and they're cycling every month, up and down, and when you ovulate, your estrogen can go easily to 500. When you're second half of your cycle, it's easily 450. So we have a lot of estrogen. And it's okay to give you a birth control pill, but something magical happens at 50 and your hormones and any other hormones now going to kill you. I'm like, but our breast cancer risk goes up, but we don't have any hormones. That doesn't make sense. It's not logical. So 22 years ago, we had a failed, horrible, poorly done study that keeps getting propagated out into the media. We took women off hormones. Did breast cancer rates go down? Not a bit. Not a bit actually went up. And we have greater incidences of heart disease, dementia, and osteoporosis from it. It defies logic to say that your hormone that your body makes suddenly becomes evil, villainous, and deadly at a magical number of 50-ish. It's the environmental chemicals. And here's my current hypothesis. It's the reason why I'm building what I'm building. My current hypothesis is, when you don't have your own estrogen to attach that keyhole and turn it on, what do you think will do it? Your pesticides, your herbicides, your phthalates, your fragrances, all of that stuff has free reign to those receptors. And I was like, and if you look at it from a logical standpoint, it's also logical. Science. It's amazing.
What are the cries for help in each stage of life for a female?
You know, if you look at very young girls, you know, as we go into puberty, right, your ovaries are kind of figuring it out. You know, and so you're getting kind of abnormal expulsion of hormones. So they're high, they're low, they're all over the place. You usually have crampy periods. Like, everything's bad. I remember when I was a kid and I was like, being a woman
sucks.
So
hard.
Yeah. I know. I was like, I don't like this.
The world is ending.
Yeah. I was like, this is terrible. What am I looking forward to? So you're in kind of hormonal chaos at that time. And then usually for most of us, it starts to normalize. We get our own cycle, which could be, 24 days to 32 days on average. And then, depending on your fertility, some women might have lower progesterone levels or higher androgens, fall into those categories of like PCOS, endometriosis. Those are all signs that the hormones are not balanced, right? Some of it genetic, but that doesn't mean you have to accept the genetics. It just means that there's some imbalances there. But I think the thing that most people get really confused by is the perimenopausal journey. We've told women that menopause is when it all happens, and that's a single day in your life. That's 1 year from the last time you had a menstrual cycle. That's the end of the perimenopausal season. But the average woman spends at least 8 years symptomatic. So remember, it's a bell curve, everybody. So that means some of us are outliers for 16, and some of us skate through with very few symptoms, right? And the lack of symptoms doesn't mean something's not going on. It just means that you're not presenting those symptoms. And so if you look at it, you have kind of three stages: early perimenopause, right, which usually means that your progesterone levels are starting to decline. Testosterone has already been sliding downhill from 20. It doesn't vary that much. It just keeps going downhill. But progesterone starts to decline, so usually you get crime scene periods, fibroids, heavy periods, more frequent periods. Like, that was what was it for me. I was like, oh, awesome. I get to have a period every 21 days, and it's like a crime scene, And so you're like, okay, never wear white. All the things you think about, how you address that time period relative to the midline where everything's starting to get crazy. So now progesterone is declining, and now estrogen has attached itself to a bungee cord. And so it's going up and down and up and down, up and down. So then you get hot flashes, night sweats, and brain fog, and, mood swings and rage and all the other sort of symptoms that can go with it, heart palpitations. What we do to address that will be different. So sometimes it's maybe putting progesterone in. Other times it might be putting progesterone and testosterone in. And then, as you enter that sort of last phase, the sort of last part of the chaotic period, what I always was afraid of, and I would say this is a disservice functional medicine does to the community, and some of it's because we're lacking the research, is I knew I was estrogen dominant. Like, anybody watching this can tell. I got a badonkadonk butt. I'm chesty. If you're curvy, you had estrogen quite a bit. Right. Mm-hmm. So I had been told, and I had had labs, previously and all this time, that said, you are estrogen dominant. So I'm like, okay, I'm terrified by estrogen. I couldn't possibly have it until the end. But when you get into that last chaotic period where it's all over the place, you can still have a period and it be very, very low. Mm-hmm. And nobody knows that. You think, oh, if I'm still having a period, I must still be estrogen dominant. And I'm not there yet, so I can't start estrogen. Right. And what I can tell you from my clinical experience and my own experience, I didn't do this with myself. I waited until it was all done right before I added estrogen because I was afraid I was going to get too much, is that you can often stabilize that bungee cord experience by stabilizing the estrogen with a little bit of replacement, depending on the person. So it's not as erratic, because the other thing, again, thinking logically, if you were a estrogen dominant woman, what do you think you have a lot of? Receptors for estrogen.
Yeah.
So who's going to feel it more profoundly when it starts to nosedive? Somebody who has a lot of receptors. And so we shouldn't take it away or be frightened of it when your body is actually crying for it, And so you have those different stages that you have to kind of look at, And then you have to add the thyroid issues and the adrenal issues and all those other things. You can't ignore that.
Can you speak to that piece? Because I feel like many people have normalize this concept of HRT. Okay, we're allowed to reach out for HRT, and then they use it as a band-aid and they don't look at deeper health issues. And they also don't understand how medicating these symptoms can actually prolong reaching solutions for these other serious health issues because you're masking a problem.
Oh my gosh.
So what would you say to that?
So even like thyroid, thyroid's the magical pill. If I'm fatigued, I'm just going to get that. I'm going to keep taking it until I can get T3 high enough, and then you don't realize that there's adrenal problems behind it and there's many, many other things. So the first thing I always tell people is think of your endocrine system as a symphony. You've got the hypothalamus, who's the director of the show. You've got the pituitary, that's the conductor talking to the endocrine glands. And the percussion is your adrenal system. So if they are playing scat jazz because you're burning the candle at both ends and you don't have to say no and all that other stuff, yeah, right? Everybody else thinks a waltz is going on. They're going to try and match the percussion because the percussion actually sets the stage for the symphony. And when one system, we'll call the brass section, the sex hormones, when they start to go off everybody starts to try and manage and bring it back into homeostasis, balance. And so the idea that
all brass all the time.
Yeah, all brass all the time. Just take brass. You don't need anybody else. We're just going to have a trombone and a trumpet, right? So the reality is you have to kind of look at all of it. And so well-meaning practitioners might put people on thyroid or might put people on estrogen. And maybe for some people, that's helpful. But let's face it, functional medicine really is for the outliers first, right? I was an outlier. Conventional medicine did nothing great for me. Right. But that outlier group that conventional medicine says we're not compliant. Don't know what they, somatization. That's what I love.
Someone called you non-compliant. I'm shocked.
But you know, so when the conventional things don't work, right, they sort of label you and you're like problem person. So the problem people are the people that seek, right? And you know, the reality is it's because the paradigm of population health is over. We're at healthcare 3.0 and that's 1-to-1, N of one. We have the capacity to do that. We need to quit acting like everybody's the same thing and it takes one thing to fix everything. And so hormones are the same way. It's not a magic pill, right? It's not a magic patch. It's not a magic cream. You have to look at the underlying root causes and start addressing them.
So what are some of those underlying root causes?
So for the deeper health issues, you know, I would say if we were to take kind of the major like center of the onion, it's the stress response. You know, I tried it myself because I love to burn the candle at both ends. It's how I ride. But the reality is you have to protect your sleep like your life depends on it. You have to do appropriate exercise for you, not too much, not too little. You have to eat right for your body. You have to learn how to say no and do boundaries. All that stuff. Like, that to me is like, if you're not doing that, there's not enough peptides, hormones, everything else on the planet to get you to 100%. Like root cause also means you got to treat your body the way it was designed to be treated, right? And some people genetically have a shoebox for their capacity to handle stuff, and other people have a wardrobe box, you know, those big ones that you can hang your stuff in. I happen to have a wardrobe box, but I have hit threshold many, many times. You look at that and you go, okay, so
you and I both have warehouses.
Yeah.
Actually, high capacity. Yeah.
Kevin and I asked one time, I was like, do you just think you're anesthetized to the stress response? I was like, possibly. Yeah, but so we have to understand that maybe our threshold isn't the same as others, and so we shouldn't do comparison, and that we all have those things that are important, but sleep, stress, you know, stress reduction, breathing, eating right, those are foundational. They're the cornerstones. You can't bypass those. There's not enough pills on the planet to fix that.
Yeah, that's really well said. What other root causes are we overlooking?
Oh, so from a hormonal standpoint, so obviously endocrine-disrupting chemicals.
Like what? What would be endocrine-disrupting chemicals?
Basically everything. You know, like, you get
down. Okay.
Well, you know, here's the thing. So if you think about it, before the industrial age, everything on the planet was organic, right? Now, we also have to remember our average life expectancy at that point was about 20 years, right? So we have to also get it. It's not like perfect. If you eat organic, it's not necessarily going to take care of everything. But the vast majority of those chemicals were created after World War II, right? And a lot of them came out of, oh, we've got these byproducts of war. We don't know what to do with them. And then
the Green Revolution, that's what they called it.
Yeah.
It's very weird, isn't it?
Marketing. Imagine that. So, you know, so none of them have really been tested significantly on humans, and especially not in combination and not in, you know, 15,000, 85,000, 100,000, you know, different chemicals together as a total load, right?
Right.
And so I think what people misunderstand is that, you know, you could be doing a lot of things to like, okay, I'm not going to use plastic. I'm going to use, you know, a water filter and, you know, distill it. And I'm going to do all this stuff. We're constantly getting bombarded. I live in Texas. You know, the car exhaust alone is enough, right? And the reality is we can't get 100% away from it. But the more we start to remove those things and support detoxification on an ongoing basis, the better we are. You know, I kind of honed my teeth 20 years ago on helping people understand detox and doing detox groups. And, you know, people are like, I'm done for the year. And I was like, girl, you just walked outside. You retoxed. Okay. So it's something you have to support all the time. It's not magic. It's like you may do some big things, but then you need to continue to support it.
So I want to talk about that because when you have such a rich toolkit at your disposal, mm-hmm. I want to make sure we get as much exposure to that as possible. So two-part question. What are some ongoing strategies that you like after people have detoxed and recovered their health? And two, are there any specific strategies you recommend for perimenopausal and menopausal women?
First off, if we look at detoxification, you know, things that, like if you have your genetics, it makes it easier. Like if you're not good at making glutathione, which is your major antioxidant and one of the major detox pathways, it helps you understand that. But even if you don't, right? Like that helps us be more precise. Even if you don't, you need to support the liver's capacity to wrap up toxins and get rid of it. And I think the hard thing is, like, I know the first time I was in biochemistry and we were talking about biotransformation, in my head, my simplistic idea was it's like having a chair and I got to get it in the trash can. It doesn't fit. So I'm going to break the legs off of it and shove it in there. That's not how detoxification works. Detoxification is different wrappers driven by different nutrients like B vitamins, amino acids, your antioxidants. They get wrapped around at different stages. They get wrapped around that piece like tissue paper, and they have to go in order, and they have to be the right color. And then once you wrap multiple wrappers around, phase one, phase two, I would argue phase three, only then can it go in the dumpster. And I think, you know, people don't think about that. And so they're like, oh, I'm going to take milk thistle or I'm going to take glutathione and it's magic. And it's like, no. There's a ton of nutrients.
Some guy told me to make a cilantro smoothie. So I'm done as long as I do that.
Can I just talk about juice fasting?
I hate it so much. Okay. Oh, my God.
Juicing vegetables and greens and things like that. Absolutely a way to get additional nutrients, right? Mm-hmm. But without amino acids, you will not detoxify a damn thing. You can't. Like, it's biochemically...
Put a little Texas twang on that for
you. You can't do that, y'all. So the reality is you actually need quite a bit of protein intake, and you need amino acids, which are liberated from proteins, both from vegetables and animal proteins. But you're just going to spin that stuff and put it right back into the cells. And you need minerals. You need electrolytes. You know, all of those pieces, they're not just cool things that you can take. They actually affect every cellular process, right? The capacity of your cell to actually excrete toxins are driven by the quality of the membrane and the mitochondria and the cell itself, right? And so, you know, I think the things people need to understand is nutrition matters, right? The nutrients matter. It's not just about the macros and I got my protein in and everything else. We need the micronutrients. And when we get those, we're halfway to the detox pathways. And then the other half is supporting by removing things and, you know, trying to reduce your environmental load as much as possible and then continuing to support those. Do things like sweat. Like if you look at some of the cardiovascular research with just doing like sauna, not even fancy infrared sauna, just getting in the hot room. Sauna, if you do it like 3 to 4 times a week, there's studies coming out of like Sweden, Denmark, literally some of them show a reduced risk for cardiovascular event, almost 50%.
It's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Cannot be ignored.
And so you're like, well, why is that? Let's see, we get vasodilation, we get heart rate differences, we get biogenesis of mitochondria, we get liberation of toxins and you're excreting. Like there's so many things that happen that just small things. You don't have to buy a fancy sauna. Come to Texas. You can come out and sweat with me every summer, because we have an infrared sauna every day.
Well,
it's important.
Like what you're emphasizing, which is passive sweat, because exercise sweat is actually, you know, you're stressing the body differently. We want to be at rest and sweating. That is a big part of the benefit.
Yes, absolutely. And so, you know, all those things help support detox. And that's something that you just put into your process each week. It doesn't have to be exact. You know, I think the other thing is we get trained that we have to have the same macros every day. Mm-hmm. Have to take my nutrients perfectly every day. Mm-hmm. I have to have my, you know, sweat on every day and then my red light and my this and that. And I'm like, no, if you look at it over the, like, just take the month and over the totality of it, if I have these things in there, in sort of a, you know, a mixture of things where I'm supporting on a regular basis, but I allow for it to not be another full-time job, that's how you execute, right? It's really hard for somebody to do all these things all the time perfectly because it does become a full-time job. Yeah. And for somebody who's sick, they might have to do that for a while.
And it's not to disparage juicing as a part of an overall thing. Because no, I can just see no the letters now. St. Clair hates juicing. How dare you?
No,
it's just that I hate the influencer thing of this is the only tool. When all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Right.
Right? When all you have is hormone pellets, everything looks like a hormone pellet problem. It's it's that orientation. And then people drinking histamine and oxalate bombs wondering, why isn't this working for me? Is my body broken? That's what I hate. So that's...
100%. Yeah. Which we could go down that oxalate histamine thing.
I know, right? Well, I actually want to hear your thoughts on that from a hormone perspective as well.
Hormone replacement therapy is not just about the hormones you make or take. It's about how you get them ready for the trash, right? Mm-hmm. And that how you get them out. And that's usually where we run into the biggest problems. But, you know, as your hormones are all over the place, we forget that estrogen acts as an antioxidant and anti-inflammatory. And when it's balanced, it's great. And when it's too low, it's not. And when it's too high, it's not. And so what's interesting is this is where all the mast cell activation, multiple chemical sensitivities. I was just joking earlier. I got to take a Benadryl today because I broke out in hives all over at a hotel. And I haven't had an anaphylactic sort of experience in a long time. But, you know, it's like, okay, what environment am I in? It's obviously not mine. You know, and so when your hormones are kind of all over, that all gets worse. So if you're loading up on oxalates, which get tied up in the body can only excrete so much of that. And so if all of a sudden you're like, I'm going to drink kale every day, you're going to get a ton of them that get stored and it binds to your calcium and it keeps you from absorbing it. But if you're varying that, you get calcium dumping or not calcium oxalate dumping or not, you get histamine response. And so you get this constellation of immune system dysregulation and estrogens whipping the horse behind it because you're in the middle of perimenopause.
Beautifully said. I have to ask before we run out of time.
Mm-hmm.
I have so much discomfort around the whole hormone replacement industry.
Oh, yeah.
Anywhere where there's just a ton of money being made, I want people to have great discernment about what are the right decisions for them. So how should we think about, or like, what are the factors when you're considering different hormone replacement therapies? Which ones are more toxic? Which ones are more, you know, compatible with your body's own strategies and rhythms?
So the rule is, if it's synthetic, like medroxyprogestin, you know, birth control pills, IUDs and things like that, you don't want those. Those are not long-term strategies for menopause, you know, perimenopause and beyond.
Why not? Why does that matter?
Oral estrogen. So the most commonly used oral estrogen for decades was Premarin. And Premarin is made from mare. So everybody, that's horse pee. It's made from pregnant horses pee. And it's got 13 estrogens in it. We only make 3. So all 13 of those estrogens, when you take them orally, go straight to the liver. They pass through those detox pathways where you've got to be able to wrap the right wrapper in the right order enough. All of those have to go through that. Then you have to actually take it, and then it goes out into the bloodstream and then starts to work. But it's not just those 13 estrogens. Now we have the other byproducts your liver made, some of which are really pro-inflammatory. And so in much older women, oral estrogen is associated with stroke and heart attack risk because of the metabolites, because it's given orally. But today, estrogen is generally given topically. There is a bioidentical form of estradiol in a pill. I'm still not a fan because, again, it's going to go to the liver first because you swallowed it. Mm. And it's given as a patch or a cream or an oil or a pellet. Here's the reality. Is pellets go underneath the muscle. They're tiny and they are bioidentical, but they have other ingredients in them that are going into your body. Your body creates a little capsule around it. It's a small surgical experience. Then your body's going to slowly absorb it. But that absorbability is just dependent on you individually, how much you exercise, your own unique biochemistry. Mm. And I have seen, we do pellets in our clinic, but it's begrudgingly. Right. But we make sure that it's moving in the right direction and it's not getting too high because over time it starts building. And then you have the patches. Well, the patches are great. They're bioidentical, but you've got an adhesive. So if you're a chemically sensitive person, do you want to stick an adhesive on you? Because they've got a bunch of polymers and other things in it that are endocrine disrupting. And then the compounded creams, in order for them not to separate. So it's kind of like if you put like mayonnaise out and let it sit, it would separate and be like oily and then chunky stuff on top. Mm. Well, they put all of these solvents in it, so it'll stay in solution. Well, those solvents are endocrine disrupting. And so there's a lot of women will say, well, I was taking this cream and it seemed to work, but this one doesn't. I'm like, it's the base, right? It's probably not the hormone, it's the base. And then, you know, like we use a bioidentical hormone and jojoba oil. 2 ingredients, that's it. 1, 2. Jojoba oil is a waxy-like oil. It absorbs rapidly to the skin and delivers without having any excipients in it. Mm. That took a long time to get to. We have to think about where we're taking it and how we're taking it. And same thing with testosterone. Testosterone is not actually FDA approved for women in female doses. Mm-hmm. So if you go to a conventional or menopause society trained doctor, they're going to give you androgel, which is dosed for a man. Then they're going to go, guess, and put a little bit on. Like, so it's imprecise. Yeah. And then they poo-poo compounded. But again, if it's compounded in cream, you are putting on, you know, a cream that's got solvents in it. Mm-hmm. We obviously do the jojoba oil, you know, and so we have to look at it and say, I don't want to take hormones that are adding additional endocrine disrupting things. Now, what I will say, if you've done good at getting everything out, would that little tiny patch or cream make a huge difference? Probably not if you kind of cleaned up your world. But if you're a super sensitive person, it might.
Yeah, I think that's really well said and super critical for people to hear. What I really want to make sure we cover today, because mm-hmm. you're such a passionate advocate mm-hmm. for women and for closing the gap mm-hmm. in research, I want you to name the problem so we all understand it mm-hmm. and give us a call to arms.
So here's the challenge. Because of the Women's Health Initiative that came out 22 years ago, women were removed from hormone replacement, right? Mm-hmm. And before that, like 40 to 70%, depending on what country you looked at, were put on hormone replacement in the form of Premarin as standard of care. There are no studies prior to that study that showed breast cancer association at all. Even in their own study, the women that took Premarin alone had a 23% reduced risk relative to the women who did nothing. And the reality is we can't take that study and generalize it to the entire population because they excluded healthy women. So the women were smokers, hypertensive, overweight and obese, pre-diabetic. Like if you are not those, you can't take that result and say it applies to me because you were left out intentionally. But because of that, women's health research has, which was already piss poor because we were left out of research until 1993. So women were left out of research. So most of the generic drugs were never tested on women. And still to this day, particularly women over 40, we're bikinis to medicine. We are reproductive organs, that's it. And then after that, it's pennies on the dollar, but we make up 50% of the population. There's 50 million women in the United States, 6,000 a day that go into menopause. So the problem is nobody in conventional medicine has cared about women. There's a lot of people jumping into the fray, but we don't have the science. So that's where Minerva comes in. We are building the first women's digital health intelligence platform to allow a woman from the comfort of her home phone to start finding out about their own symptoms when they're wearing wearables. I'm an overachiever. I got two on today because I'm comparing them. All their other stuff to start normalizing that data so they can understand their own experience, their own lab work, their own parts. And so when they do hormone replacement, they can work with somebody that actually uses the most non-toxic available hormones available. But we're also tracking how you take it, when you take it, what else you're taking, and what's happening with your hormones. So we can actually help create a preventative, predictive, and proactive hormone replacement and women's health platform for each individual, but then it will be the largest database of women's health in the world.
First of all, that's stunning.
Yeah.
I know we're out of time, but I have to comment on the conversation happening behind the scenes because I have been appalled at some of the VC conversations that you're having, because in order for this to work and change the world, you must scale. We all know there's huge money in health and health data right now. And yet what I'm hearing is this getting dismissed in almost like ridiculously.
Ridiculous. Yeah. So of the 100% of available private equity and venture capital money, less than 2% go to female founders, although we actually outperform male-founded companies by 62%. And I've been told by different groups, they're like, if you're doing women's health, no one cares. I'm like, okay, all right. So the reality is the Dalai Lama said it was the midlife American woman that was going to change the world, right? What we need to understand as women of all ages, but particularly if you happen to be slightly seasoned like I am, we have access, we have assets, and we have anger.
And we're the decision makers in our homes.
100%.
About health.
So. Yeah, 100%.
Fucking listen.
I'm going to share a funny story now that you said that. So I had a man tell me, he said, jokingly, I'm in Texas, so you know we have some challenges with women's health autonomy. And he sort of said, well, you guys don't get to make decisions about your health anyway. And so I looked at him and I was like, well, that's so funny, sweet pea, which is usually me being Southern. And I said, so funny, sweet pea, honey, you don't make decisions about your health. We schedule your urologist, your internal medicine doctor, your cardiology appointment. We schedule our grandkids and our kids. We control the purse strings. Women, particularly middle-aged women, make 87% of all medical decisions. And if you add household, it's 85%. We absolutely control the world. We just need to recognize it and step into that power.
I couldn't have said it better myself. Thank you so much for your advocacy.
No, thank you.
Thanks for spending this time with us today. I know these conversations can bring up a lot, and I want you to have room to sit with what you learned and let it land in your own body. If you want more support or you're curious about the next step on your healing path, you can always connect with me. Find me on Instagram at TheDetoxNation and explore resources mentioned in this episode at detoxnation.com. This conversation is shared for education and personal reflection and isn't medical advice. Please always work with your trusted healthcare providers for your care. I'm really glad you're here, and I'll see you in the next episode.